succession number 20272, reel 1.
Major Symes, reel 1, where were you born, please? Where were you born?
Guernsey.
Which year was this?
1919.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Guernsey?
Yes.
And were your parents both from Guernsey?
Yes.
How old were you when you left, finished your schooling?
18.
So, that was in 37?
No, 38. I was coming up to 19, but I finished in July 38 when I was 18 and three quarters. Roughly.
What happened to you on leaving school?
I went to Sandhurst as a cadet. The Royal Military College, Sandhurst, not the Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst.
What kind of experiences did you have there?
a blur. I only did two terms because war was coming and so they chucked us out. But I would say that it was a constant rushing of and changing of uniforms, basically.
What had decided you on an army career?
Because I failed to get a scholarship to Oxford and nobody really knew what to do with me. I was head prefect at this at school. I was at Elizabeth College, Guernsey. And one day I happened to see some papers for the army entrance examination for Sandhurst and Woolwich. And I looked at them and I thought, well, this is right up my street. I can answer all these questions easily. So I applied to go to the army. I applied. And I was had to go in front of a board in London. I think there were about three generals, or might have been five. Anyway, quite a lot of old men who only asked me one question. They said, well, what tie are you wearing? And I said, I'm wearing the Duke of York's camp tie. So they said, tell us all about the Duke of York's camp. So I told them that the Duke of York had an idea, a very good one, that if he could get together people, say, of my type, public school educated, and an equal number of state school educators, and mix us up for a fortnight in Southwold, in Suffolk, we, both sides, would get to know the others better. And I told them this, these generals, and they never asked a question. They thanked me very much. I went. I passed into Sandhurst 17th. And I don't know what I passed out, but it wasn't very 60-something, I think, 60-something. So I didn't do very well at Sandhurst.
Did this Duke of York's camp work in the way it was intended?
Oh, yes, there's no doubt. I'll give you an example. We slept in on palliasses in a tent. Well, there were 40 of us to a tent. And we went public school boy, state school boy, so like all the way around. And I slept next door to a chap who worked for Gillette Blades. And I reckon he must have been a marvellous maker of Gillette razor blades, but what he couldn't do was write. And on the Sunday afternoon we were there, we had to send a postcard home. And he turned to me and he said, would you mind writing this postcard for me? And I said, not at all, which I did. And I've never forgotten this and made quite an impression on me. In fact, later on, I went to, no, before that, I'd already been to Yorkshire. My father had sent me to Yorkshire to live with a miner's family so that I would get an idea as to what life on the other side was, as opposed to the cushy life I was having in Guernsey. And I think those two things, really, I'm going off the beaten track at the moment, but I think that those two things made such an impression on me that I've never forgotten them.
Wow.
So, sorry.
What lessons did you learn from the miners' family?
Well, I never... The miners, how well off I was. And we only had one good meal a week. I was there for a fortnight. Well, on the Sunday, we had a very good meal. The father was out of work, as a matter of fact. His son was the same age as I was, but I had sixpence in the old money per day as my pocket money, and he had nothing, tuppence, something like that. And I used to buy all the sarsaparilla we used to drink. We played cricket in these narrow walled areas, you know, that was rows of houses, and the only playing field they had was the back behind the garden, in the street. That's the sort of impression it made on me, that I was bloody lucky.
How on earth had your father been able to arrange this?
Well, because a friend of his in Guernsey came from there, and my father had happened to mention, I suppose, and this man arranged it with a friend of his in... where the hell was it? It was in Yorkshire. They've got a very good rugby team.
Doncaster.
Castleford. Castleford, it was called. Not Castleford, Castleford.
And what, did you hear Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I was in Winchester Cathedral. I didn't hear him. The bishop announced it. At that time, I was with the depot, regimental depot in Winchester. And on the Sunday morning, I asked the adjutant if I could go to the cathedral. That was on the 3rd, wasn't it? 3rd of September. He said, okay, and I heard it there in the cathedral.
How did you feel?
Well, I rushed back to the... can't remember how I felt. I remember I rushed back to the barracks, found I couldn't get in because they'd locked all the gates because war had been declared.
Did you feel any sense of dismay about it?
No, I don't think so. I don't think I was up to that sort of feeling. Don't forget, I was just a second lieutenant who'd been knocked about at Sandhurst and had been told to obey orders. Well, I suppose, really. I mean, I don't know. Thinking back, all I can see is myself running back from the cathedral up to the depot.
And was the Royal Hampshire Regiment an automatic choice for you?
No. I was hoping to go to the Gurkhas. At Elizabeth College, all the people who went to Sandhurst, virtually all went to the Gurkhas. In fact, I think at one time there were 5 OEs, old Elizabethans, in the Gurkhas. And it was decided that I would go to the Gurkhas. Now, unfortunately for me, I suppose, in a way, or perhaps I got out of it far better than I thought, my father knew a general in Guernsey, General Williams, Major General, who had served in the Hampshire Regiment. And I was the head boy at Elizabeth College, and I had to attend the annual dinner of old Elizabethans as the guest of honour. But I had to make a speech. And apparently and General Williams was the chairman of this, of the old Elizabethan Association. And he was present at this dinner, and he heard me speak, and he rang my father up and said, that boy of yours is not going to the Gurkhas, because he'd asked me at the dinner what I was going to do. He said, he's going to my regiment, and I'm going to fix it. So he wrote to the colonel of the regiment, and who had served under him in Gallipoli, and said, this young man is going to the regiment, do something about it. And I joined the Hampshires. It was funny that I was the junior subaltern, and in those days I was in the 2nd battalion. The 1st battalion was in Egypt, and the 2nd battalion sent the reinforcements to the 1st battalion. And I was at the bottom of the list of the subalterns to go to join the battalion in Egypt when an order came through from the War Office saying that I was to be the first one to go. Fortunately, war was declared and I didn't go, but there was old General Williams who fixed it with the colonel of the regiment that I would have preference. It's absolutely true, I'm telling you. And so I didn't go to Egypt. I stayed with the 2nd battalion in Aldershot.
What type of duties did you have?
I was a platoon commander, and I had 12 men. 12, I had my platoon. I was in Z Company. There were three officers. There was Captain Sanguinetti, Blood, known as Peter Halliday, who died 10 days ago, and myself, with these 12 men. And the second battalion was very undermanned, and all regular, of course. The National Service had just, I think it was just about coming in. This was July 39. And eventually a lot of reservists came in. And they'd all been on the northwest frontier of India. They were all tough as hell. They were joined nice chaps. And I was a platoon commander, but you see, on the war was declared on the 3rd of September, and about that time that the battalion was in the 1st Guards Brigade. There were the 3rd Grenadiers, 2nd Coldstream, and 2nd Hampshire's. That was the brigade under Brigadier Alexander, who became Field Marshal. A certain number of officers were left behind as a reserve. And there were four of us, second lieutenants, left behind. When the battalion went to France, after war was declared with this brigade, we four went to the depot in Winchester as reinforcements for the 2nd Battalion. Because as the war really didn't start till May 1940, there was no chance of us joining the 2nd Battalion. And we stayed at the depot for a short time when we were posted to the infantry training, what's it called, ITC, Infantry Training Centre in the Isle of Wight at Albany Barracks. And there I was a platoon commander with training National Service soldiers, who then went off to various battalions which were forming of the regiment. There was the 9th Battalion, the 10th Battalion, all sorts of numbers. And I was then posted from there to a holding battalion to go to France, and I went to the 13th Holding Battalion in Seaford in Sussex. Some people call it Seaford, I don't know. Where I stayed till the Germans blasted through in northern France, when there was no point in having this holding battalion anymore, because we would never have got to France. There was no point. So the battalion was disbanded. It wasn't only Hampshire, it was Queens, West Kent, and Royal Sussex, and the Hampshire's form. Four different regiments had a company each in this battalion for reinforcing their own units abroad. And I went then to join the 50th Battalion, the Hampshire Regiment. 50 was a phony number given to a lot of battalions, a lot of regiments, to make the Germans think that if anybody caught said he came from the 50th Battalion, the regiment, I mean, they would have gone spare. They're, you know, calculating, where the hell are all these soldiers coming from? But anyway, I joined the 50th Battalion, the most important person I was. I was the second lieutenant. I was assistant adjutant, but furthermore, I was intelligent officer West White. And it was while I was intelligence officer West, while I was in this battalion, that Hubert Nicol, no, a chap came who'd been at school with me, a fellow called Philip Martel, who came down and he said, he asked to see the commanding officer, and he came down to ask if I was prepared to go to Guernsey in the near future. And the CO asked me if I'd like to go to Guernsey, and I said, yes, I'll go. So I went with Hubert Nicol, who was the second lieutenant in the Hampshire Regiment, because when he and Martel had been in the Royal Guernsey Militia, and the Royal Guernsey Militia was disbanded and came over to England, like the Royal Militia Island of Jersey was disbanded, and they either formed the 13th Battalion of the regiment, or they went to the 9th Battalion of the regiment, I think, if I remember rightly. Anyway, Hubert Nicol had already been to Guernsey and had come out from Guernsey, and he was summoned to the Admiralty again, because he went in by submarine and came out by submarine. And he was asked if he would go again, and he said he would go on condition that I went with him. I used to play inside left in the football team, and he played inside right. And between us, we had there was something between us like that on the football pitch, which made us friends for life, really. So this was what all that was about, and I said, yes, I'll go. So I went up to London with Nicole. At that time, was in Parkhurst, in this other holding unit. So I went over to see him, and he had a lot of photographs of German planes, which we had to look at and memorize. And then we set off for London, where we were both asked if we'd go, and yes, and did we realize that if we were caught, nobody could help us. And like idiots, we both said yes, we realized. We were only 20 at the time, both of us. And we went over by MTB, motor torpedo boat.
What did you take with you?
Nothing. Yeah, I took 5 and 4 pence halfpenny and a flask of brandy. That's all I took with me. I dressed in sillies. I was dressed in a Guernsey, so was he. And that was all we had, because we were going to be there for 3 days, and then they would come and pick us up. And we could do what we liked on the island, as long as we got information on the civilian aspects of the island, not the German military side so much, but they wanted to know in London how the people were being treated. Those were our tasks. And at the end of the period, we went back to where we'd... Oh, the other... We did take one thing with us. We took a torch, quite a large torch, which had a metal funnel put on it, so that when it shone out to sea, the beam was restricted by this funnel, and all we had to do was once every, what was it? I think it was once every hour or half hour, we had to signal the letter dot dash dot S. Is that S? Dot, dot, dash, dot. In other words, dot and a longer one and a shorter one. Straight out to sea. We were on a bay. I'll show you. Would you like to see the picture?
I can look
at it afterwards. Where we sat there. They would pick us up at approximately 3 a.m. They never came. So we went back to our respective homes. And the following night, we went back to this beach. And they never came. And on the third night, there was a hell of a storm. Anyway, we instead of concentrating on one beam down the middle every hour or whatever, I forgot what the timing was, we decided to do one left, one center, one right, like that, in case the ship, this motor torpedo boat, was out there somewhere and couldn't see the beam on the direct line. Never came. So we both went back to our respective homes, and we'd been told before we left London that if nobody came to find us, it was always done on during the period, I'm rambling a bit here, it was always done when the on a period when there was no moon, so that if nobody came, we were to wait wherever we were till the next no moon period, and then we would have to go back again to the coast, to the same place, and signal again. Oh no, I beg your pardon, that's wrong. Somebody would come and look for us, but a chap came and he got caught. Fortunately for him, he was in uniform, and he couldn't be treated like we could have been if we'd been caught, because we were in civilian clothes. He John Parker, Captain John Parker, he told the Germans he was on a recce. I don't know whether they believed it or not. Anyway, he became a prisoner of war. So we had to sit at home and wait for the next new moon. Between the time of the September new moon and the this late September and October, the Germans wanted to issue an order that anybody after Parker wanted to issue an order in Guernsey that if there were any British soldiers in hiding in the island, they'd already done this once when they first got there, and they got a few in who were on leave. If these people gave themselves up, they would be treated as prisoners of war, and those who helped them would not be punished. Now, we had a friend in court, Ambrose Sherwell, became Sir Ambrose Sherwell, who was the he was the head of the States anyway. He was the head man over there. Clever man. He saved our lives. He persuaded the Germans. He put up a draft for the letter that should have go out into the press. The notice that I've got a copy out there, which should go out to the press. He did, knowing full well that we were there. He got the thing worded in such a way that we could go and give ourselves up as if we'd stayed behind we were on leave when the Germans arrived. And under the terms of that letter, became a German proclamation, we eventually gave ourselves up with 5 minutes to go to the time when we should have done it on October the 21st, Trafalgar Day, 1940, gave ourselves up to the local police, who then told the Germans, and we were then spies, captured spies. Terrible now, thinking of it. Anyway, we were court-martialed by the Germans. We were sentenced to death. We were then relieved because of this letter. We were taken to France. We went to the prison of Cherche Midi in Paris, where Dreyfus was at one time. So we were in good company. We spent 2.5 months in solitary confinement there. And then just before Christmas, my father died in the prison. My mother was in the prison. A lot of our friends were in this prison. Terrible place. It no longer exists. And we were told on the 21st of December, was it, or thereabouts, that the Germans had decided we should be treated as prisoners of war.
Could I just go back and take you through it so I can clarify what you've just told me? Go back to when you were taken on the mission. This was in October
1940.
What was your landing like originally?
Oh, no problem at all.
Where did you land?
We landed at Petitpore Bay.
Why there?
Because that's where we knew. Well, A, it had. We both knew it because we used to spend most of our holidays at Petitpore. And we knew the ropes, how to get up the cliffs. I mean, it was on a Petitpore. I suppose the cliffs must be 300 feet there. We knew there were two exits from Petitpore Beach. We knew that the MTB could come in very close on high tides there, so we wouldn't have to walk very far. In fact, the Navy told us it would be the highest tide of the year. In actual fact, when we got there, it was the lowest tide of the year, and we had quite a lot of beach to cover to get into the rocks, and then we had the possibility of going up on the right-hand side, which was, looking at it, which was about 350 steps up the cliff face. And we could go the other side of the beach, which very few people knew about. There was a track that led up to the top of the cliffs, and that's the one we chose. And every time we went back to that beach with our old torch, which we left, I'm sure, in the cave where we were sitting doing this sort of stuff, we used to go on that particular track. And we went up and down there, went up 4 times, down 3. There. That answer?
And what time of day was it?
Oh, night. Oh, at night.
Early
hours?
Yeah.
We went, as I say, we used to start, I can't remember exactly when we started, at what hour we started signalling.
And where had you set off from?
Oh, I'd stayed with my girlfriend at the other end of the island.
No, from England, when you were in England.
Oh, from Portland. Portland. Now, what is interesting, I traced the captain of the MTB. I wrote to the Admiralty, and I had a hell of a told them, gave them the bare bones of the thing, and I asked them if they could give me any details of the I wanted the number of this MTB and why it hadn't come to pick us up. Mind you, this is what I'm talking about. 50 years later when I did this. So, but my letter fell in the hands of Sir Jock Slater's PA, Commander Smith, Lieutenant Commander Smith, and he was absolutely marvellous. He was terribly intrigued by this story that I'd given, and he wrote and he said, it can either be MTB 69, or the records are appalling, or 70, and he gave me the names of the two commanding officers of those MTBs who had taken command of their ships, or their boats, I suppose, the day before, only. And they were lieutenants in the Navy, regular lieutenants, or sub-lieutenants. They were regular lieutenants, and they had on board a sub-lieutenant and the crew, and us, and also somebody who was going into Jersey that night. But we arrived very late. I know we arrived, we landed about 3 a.m, and we were due to be there at midnight. But I don't know what happened, because we didn't know. We were down in the wardroom, just waiting to be called on deck to go ashore. So when they got to Guernsey so late, they didn't go on to Jersey to land a chap called Le Mesurier, who eventually became the bailiff of Jersey, funny enough. He didn't land, because it would have been light by the time they got there. And also having to go back over the channel, across the channel. I mean, German Stukas might have easily come down and banged them. And he went again the following night, I think it was. He never landed, for some reason or other. But we did. He became, I'm not saying anything. I mean, he didn't have to go through the trauma, not so much that we had to go through, as what our families had to go through. In fact, I didn't stay with my parents at the start, A, because it was very difficult for me to get there, unseen, because we lived in a terrace. We lived in a little lane of about 5 houses. And I'm sure I couldn't have gone down that lane.
What was the address of that?
Oh, that was, gosh, 11.
It doesn't matter.
Anyway, 11 something. So I went to stay right out the far end of the island, where I had a very good, I was on a very good line of sight for the airfield. I couldn't see the airfield. I was about 2 or 3 miles away, but I could see the taking off and landing from there. Really, and the chap I stayed with was my girlfriend's father. I full marks to him for putting me up for the 3 days, and he worked in the States of Guernsey, so he had quite a knowledge of the political side. Hubert Nicol's father was the Secretary of the States, and so he got the information that London wanted. Unfortunately, it never got back. But after that, after we'd done the 3 nights, I realized that as we had to wait another month, I couldn't go back to this man and his daughter, that I had to go home. And so I went home. And I stayed there till October the 21st, when I gave myself up.
What was the address of your girlfriend?
Oh, God, I think it was called Valnor. It was in St. Peter's, or Torteval, their parishes. It was out there, I don't know where the hell it was, because they did, before the war, they didn't live there. It was only after war was declared that they went there.
And what did you learn about the way in which the civilians were being treated?
Oh, we knew. I mean, these two people told, everybody knew what was happening over there. At that time, nobody was being killed or anything. I think the Germans just took over and made rules and regulations, and people had to obey them.
And how had you felt when you first heard that Guernsey had fallen to the Germans?
I don't know. It's difficult to say what one thinks all those years ago. Don't know.
And the whole of your family were in Guernsey?
My father and mother, and my brother, my younger brother.